you know, backtrack to finish off on Bevan. Would you concur with what everyone seems to say about him, that his essential characteristic was that he could have two selves? There was a parliamentary Welsh rhetorician speaking a socialist idea, much of it apparently SMA influenced, and then there was the man who dined with Lord Moran, the hard-headed negotiator, the man who could see the BMA had to be sort of appeased or whatever, and that the actual outcome of the contract, the negotiations, as it were, was a hard-headed contract where most people were satisfied, while he was also able to talk extravagantly in the parliamentary situation, and that Bevan's importance was this ability to compromise.
I would agree with that entirely. In fact, curiously enough, you are saying what I said in the typescripts which I sent to Paulson, which they cut out. They might almost have handed you the piece they'd cut out. he was a realist. He wanted the best service for the people. Therefore, he said, we must allow the consultants private practice, otherwise many of the best will not come in. We must let them have private practice in hospital and see their patients in hospital, but so that they spend more time in hospital.
Can I stop you there and change?
Yes. Much time in the hospital available to treat emergencies and not be either away in their private consulting rooms or travelling to and from them. That was his realism. The other thing that you mentioned, he was the politician, but I felt that he didn't like doctors. And remembering that the Welsh valleys didn't always attract the best type of medical practitioner, I felt I could understand that. Now, that was unfortunate. It rubbed off, we felt it. And then the politician who came out from time to time from the other side and put his big foot right in it. The second reading of the NHS bill took place, as Honig's points out, when we were sitting in an SRM over the same period of 2 or 3 days. We had copies of Hansard in front of us. Bevan was asked, why haven't you brought in a salaried service for GPs? And he said, because they are not ripe for it. And that made us feel that this was merely the first stage and he intended to bring in that service. I don't think he did. In a moment of stupidity, he had let that out, and it caused the fiercest conflict for over 2 years. Just in the same way that he made another unfortunate reference to vermin the day before the National Health Service started, incidentally.
Yeah. Thank you, that's very interesting. And perhaps let's just go back and to finish off on this, the financial thing. I mean,
yes.
Let's just ask a very simple question. It gets more and more expensive. Things get run down. There is politicisation of the service unions. You know, it's quite a different situation, you might say. It's become extremely expensive, and just like that.
Yes.
There's political activity through service unions and indeed union views on pay beds, as you know. Is there any way that an ordinary layman could be persuaded how it will go on existing, given that it goes on being so damn expensive? I mean, what would be... See, Powell would say, would you just have to give more things to the private world, or whatever, the state simply must stop paying out so much. I mean, is there any solution that the layman could understand where it would remain a state service, a national service, given that it goes on being so expensive?
Well, at the moment, and there is, of course, an ever-increasing demand, both from doctors and patients, to do more in the service, that means making it cost more. And both will have to see that there is a limit. And patients, such as the lay people, will have to realize that you cannot go on spending ever-increasing sums on the service. And they will have to feel that they have a responsibility for their own health in many ways, in what they eat, in what they drink, and in what they, how far they smoke. And in many, many ways, the service has lagged behind in preventive medicine. That is, to my mind, its great failing.
That's interesting, just to be asked in detail there. Does the failure of the accent on preventive medicine reflect any organisational point at the origins? Because it did seem, unless I've got this quite wrong, it seems as it were the local authorities became responsible for ideas of preventive medicine or, you know, health care of the kind of social kind, and this was actually rather unimportant in the overall structure of the hospital, of the medical services in general, that there was no one around really arguing for preventive medicine in the original NHS organisation. Is that right? But it was a bit of a side issue and is now becoming a central issue.
No. The responsibility rests on the population, not on doctors. The ultimate responsibility. Every nation gets the doctors it deserves. This nation is not strong on prevention. There is no great demand for prevention except from a small and intelligent minority who want it for other people. What John Bull wants is a cure for whatever illness he has got. And as soon as he is cured, he wants to forget entirely about it and is not interested in thinking how he can prevent it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Right.
And I went into this. I think the first point to make is that there's a long history. You don't want me to hold that, do you?
No.
Going back to I don't think so. Going back to the whole interwar period of argument and debate about improving health services. It didn't just happen during the war. And the BMA itself has been campaigning for all sorts of changes, quite apart from anyone else. And one of the effects of the war really was to bring all this to a head, all these arguments. So where PEP comes in is that at that time it was an extremely influential non-party, if you like, progressive study group. Not socialist, with no particular party flavour, which brought together large numbers of people who were worried about the state of the economy, the mass unemployment of the early 30s, the apparently negative attitude of governments. I suppose broadly they were all Keynesians in outlook. And these included a great many businessmen like Israel Zeef, for instance. He wasn't the only one. I think Derek Ezra, the young man, was involved. Quite a lot of the more thoughtful politicians. And a great many very senior civil servants who used to come round to Queen Anne's Gate and sort of blow off steam in private. You see, it was a kind of club, but also a research institute. And it worked essentially through study groups. And I began my career as a young research worker working for one of these study groups. And when the war came, a lot of things happened. I was one of the, I don't know whether the best word is fortunate few not to be called up. I expected to be called up, but I wasn't. So I was then switched on to preparing material to submit to the Beveridge Inquiry. And in the process, I became rather an expert on these matters. We were concerned in the first instance with Social Security, you know, cash payments and all the rest of it. But we couldn't avoid the issue of medical care, health services. Now, PEP before the war, shortly before the war, had brought out an enormous volume, a report on Britain's health services, which became a standard textbook. It gathered a great deal of new material about hospitals, for instance, that wasn't widely known. And it made all kinds of proposals for improving and extending public health services anyway. So we already had that reputation, but I hadn't been involved at that time. As I was saying, after the Beveridge report was published and its proposals had quite a resemblance to PEP's own thinking, we decided the best thing to do to follow up the Beveridge report, apart from doing further studies in Social Security, was to develop the assumption it made about having a comprehensive public health service open to the whole population. And so we formed a high-powered study group. It included, for instance, the Medical Officer of Health of the London County Council, who was responsible for the biggest hospital service in the whole country. I think he had 90-odd hospitals under his direct control, apart from other services. It included one of the ministry's own medical advisors. We had a lot to do with the chap you mentioned just now, Lord, what's his name?
Stephen Taylor.
Stephen Taylor, yeah. Yes. We had all kinds of people like that.
If you just ask a general question, I mean, when the health service came into existence, if you had to be sort of given, as it were, a social historical description of how that happened, was it the outcome of, as it were, a contract, collaboration between parties you might assume to be inimical to each other? I mean, the doctors, the state, the internal divisions within the profession. Or was it really kind of uncontroversial I mean, could you say something about the details of its structural foundations? Because the general tone of the way we've been going so far and talking to people we have is that there were detailed debates, and the doctors were scared by some of what Bevan was playing with, as it were. But in the end, it was remarkably uncontroversial.
I mean, well, I wouldn't entirely agree with that. Let me just finish with P.E.P. Yeah. I don't want to exaggerate our role, but you asked me to talk about
Sorry.
It.
No, no.
But we were in a position to know all that was going on, so to say, behind the scenes. We knew what the ministry were up to in one way. We knew what the BMA was up to. Oh, yes, we had Dr. Talbot Rogers, a GP from Bromley, who was high in the BMA councils and was, so to say, on the left. I don't know whether he was actually a socialist, but he was out of sympathy with Charles Hill. And so one way or another, we knew all that was going on, you see. Now, coming on to the main issue, the way I would put it was this, that, as you must be aware, owing to the changes brought about by the war itself, the emergency medical service, the commandeering, the hospitals, they're organizing into a regional system and all the rest of it, it rapidly became clear that we couldn't go back to the pre-war system. And quite early on, the Ernest Brown, I think was the first minister, had indicated in Parliament that the government was wondering about the possibility of a greatly extended public health service. Was thinking of a salaried service too. So one way or another, the various medical bodies got rather worried and thought that they ought to do some thinking of their own. And they ended up creating what they call the Medical Planning Commission. And this Medical Planning Commission, Stephen Taylor was pretty active in it, among others. I think it brought all the Royal Colleges and the BMA together. Came out with what at the time was a remarkably progressive report. You must have seen it. Now that was at the point. That was the point at which Beveridge wrote his report, and basically all that he really said was, "Well, the Medical Planning Commission, the most representative body the doctors have ever had, has already said A, B, C, and D, that it favours a comprehensive health service, etc., etc." The only point, the only major point on which there is disagreement is whether this service should be open to the entire public or whether there should remain a minority who would be excluded on grounds of income. But they are agreed that if there is such a minority, it couldn't be more than 10%, that 90% at least would have to be in the service. So Beveridge went on to say, in view of this agreement, it's quite plain that there is no major obstacle to creating a comprehensive health service after the war. And then he went on to give other reasons why this was a good thing, you see. So to that extent, one could say that there was already a fundamental acceptance of the need for a big change. All sorts of other groups, the Liberal Party and all sorts of other groups, came out with schemes of their own. I think I've got them all in a box somewhere. I collected them at the time. And finally, the coalition government itself brought out the Willink white paper, which accepted as its starting point that there must be a service of this sort, that wanted to keep the voluntary hospitals in one way or another, didn't want to upset the structure of local government, and in all sorts of ways, tried to design a service which wouldn't involve too much change, either in the structure of local government or in the familiar voluntary hospital scene. And what followed after that, I suppose, was a big argument about whether the Willink scheme was feasible. There were so many groups with vested interests that once you started compromising, there was no foretelling where the compromises would end. And then there were all the problems about whether GPs should be put on salaries, whether the sale of practices should be abolished, what should be the terms of remuneration of consultants and other hospital doctors, what on earth could be done about using charitable bodies like voluntary hospitals to work at the public expense while retaining their charitable character, and so on and so forth. I think it's fair to say that Willink really never got around to solving those questions. Now, the impression I had at that time was that some of the top men in the ministry who'd had a taste of power, you must remember that the old Ministry of Health had never itself managed services on a big scale. What it did was to supervise and regulate what other people did, and local authorities in particular, and it handed out grants to voluntary hospitals and the like. But during the war, the ministry itself had to run services on a big scale, the whole emergency hospital scheme. And some of the abler men in the ministry had got, if you like, a taste of power. They'd acquired the habit of taking big decisions and running big and expensive services. And there was a group of them, and Horton, I'm sure, was their main intellectual inspirer, who were very pleased when Nye Bevan came along. And they were able to start afresh and give Nye Bevan the idea that the best thing to do to solve this hospital problem was to take all the hospitals out of the hands of their former owners, whether they were local authorities, whether they were counties or cities or charitable trusts or whatever they were, and make a fresh start. And it so happened that on the whole, the spokesmen of the consultants were in favor of this idea too. They were determined that not to have a service in which consultants and other hospital doctors were employed by local authorities, for instance. They didn't like the whole setup of local authority hospitals, where you had one man who would, you quite often a second-rate doctor, but a competent administrator, who was the medical superintendent and had clinical control of the medical staff, who might be far more competent in medicine than he was. They weren't all that keen on the voluntary hospital system because it didn't pay them. Didn't pay them properly. It paid the juniors, but not very much. And the seniors were expected to make a living from, in the main, from private practice. And so they were quite receptive to this idea because they saw that they would have a great influence in how the hospitals were managed. and they would only have to deal with government and not with anyone else. And I think that was Bevan's master stroke. That's what I was going to say. I got to know Bevan, saw a fair amount of him when he was minister. And I'm pretty sure that when he became minister, this was a subject about which he didn't know much, that he had no fixed ideas at all. I don't think he arrived in the ministry having already decided that he must nationalise the hospitals. That's my impression. I don't know whether other people have confirmed this, but he was a tycoon, let's say, apparently used to quick decisions, and I don't quite know at what point he took the decision, but pretty quickly. And it was certainly not a matter that was ever discussed in Labour Party circles. Again, I had my PhD student go into this in as much detail as he could. He explored all the archives in Labour Party, TUC and other circles, and he was not able to find any evidence at all that this had ever been seriously pressed in any discussions. The whole Labour approach right up to and during the war was to hand all the hospitals over to local authorities. They wanted gradually the bigger local authorities, the county councils and the city councils, to actually take over the voluntary hospitals. And their whole line of thinking was for a comprehensive municipal hospital service. And that, of course, is entirely in line with Labour thought throughout most of this century, going right back to Sidney and Beatrice Webb. At the beginning of the century, they put out a quite comprehensive model for a welfare state based on local government. They found it difficult to fit national health insurance into that picture, when that was really a liberal invention. They didn't like it, but they accepted it in the end. But they didn't see it as the basis for developing health services. And so when Bevan took this decision, it immediately led to a big row in Labour circles, especially in London, where the, I don't know whether Labour Party controlled the London County Council at that time, do you happen to remember? But Herbert Morrison in particular, they were all looking forward to the day when the London County Council would take over all the other hospitals, all the big teaching hospitals and the like. And they had, along with Middlesex, I suppose the best developed municipal hospital systems in the whole country, and they were very good, despite their limitations. How it was that Bevan won this battle so easily with his own colleagues, I don't really know, and this is where memoirs and other papers may throw some light, but according to my PhD student, there wasn't great resistance to him, although it was a novel thought, that he rapidly gained the support of nearly all his important ministerial colleagues. I suppose they simply felt that something had to be done, and it all the alternatives were going to take far too long. They were politically committed, and so on.
But in some way, one of the things he did which was striking was to not see through the 45 manifesto. I mean, he actually did, as it were, withdraw from a full socialised medicine, as it were, in very important points. So part of his skill was to concede.
Oh, yes.
in, you know, ways that were not the same thing as his political theory was. I mean, his political programme, as it were, slightly separate from what he actually did.
Yeah, could you remind me what was in that manifesto? It's, I can't
remember just 100% precisely. Service. And, I mean, presumably there was a general sort of wordy commitment to a salaried service.
He'd actually use that
term, I think so. I wouldn't like to quote it on that. But yeah. Certainly he didn't, as it were, see through the 45 scheme. That's part of his skill, if you like.
Yes, Bevan was very willing to compromise on most things that involved money, as long as he had his way on bigger issues. He was quite prepared to lavish money on consultants, for instance. And for instance, he agreed, contrary, I'm pretty sure, to Labour policy, that consultants should be allowed to treat private patients in pay beds in the health service, and that they needn't work full time. They could so that they could have part of the week for treating private patients. He eventually gave in on the matter of what was called a basic salary for GPs, and there was a good case for that. I know what PEP we thought there was. But, for instance, he remained adamant about the sale of practices, and I think rightly. But he was very flexible.
Did in the tripartite structure, do you think that power was evenly distributed in the end, or could one argue that at the original foundation of the service there were imbalances in the representation of particular doctoral interests, the consultants as against the GPs, the Hönigsbaum view, which is that by the end of whatever, I mean, up in the next 20 years, the general practitioner becomes too isolated from hospital practice. I mean, were there difficulties in the actual founding structure of the service, do you think?
I think there were, yes. Let me think this out for a minute. The tripartite structure, and I'm quite sure I said this at the time, and I've certainly said it ever since, created a system in which all the emphasis and all the prestige was put on the hospital part. So that whenever there are very often two ways of, or more than two ways of providing medical care. One is through a hospital-based service, and another is through, shall we call it, a community-based service. Whenever such choices were made, all the weight was in favour of the hospital solution, which is usually the most expensive, because nowhere in the country was there, not in a single city or county, was there a health authority that could look at the whole picture. There was a hospital authority, there was a local authority until recently, and then there were the GP services. But there wasn't one budget, there wasn't a group who had to decide, shall we spend more on A and less on B, or the other way round. And all that favoured the hospital solution to one problem after another. Now that, I'm sure, was bound up with the strength of the organisations representing consultants as against those representing GPs. I'm not clear, however, whether the bodies representing GPs had a clear view of an alternative system. They certainly weren't campaigning for a unified health authority in each area. And I myself and my friends at PEP, until Bevan produced this alternative, were thinking in terms of small regions, 40 or 50 small regions rather than big ones, the hospital regions that eventually emerged, in each of which there would be some kind of unified authority dealing with all branches of the medical service. But we didn't get our way because we hadn't got muscle. So I think this is where Honigsbaum is almost certainly right, that it was the relative public influence and political pull of these various groups which to a very considerable extent determined the outcome.
I just wonder, I mean, I know you might have launched the idea of a general question to sort of finish off, but I mean, just could you just reflect as, in any way you'd like on whether it's been a success story, whether it's in trouble, from what you can see of it, over, I mean, just as a lay person, as it were, and whether there are any senses in which some of the difficulties that the service may now be in are related to its historical genesis. I mean, does it seem, from your point of view, to have been, generally speaking, a happy outcome? Is it now in trouble? How does it feel?
Oh, now we're straying from, yes.
Straying from history, well, just a sort of reflection, really.
Yes. I think weighing it up, I would put the main emphasis on the side of success. I think in many respects it's been an outstanding success, despite all the troubles and difficulties that there have been. I think it was done at the right point, and that is that if we had delayed, say, for 10 years after the war before doing this, we would have lost whatever chance there may have been of steering the medical profession in the direction of accepting the ethic of a public service as against the ethics of the marketplace. We've not been all altogether successful, but I think we've got a good way in that direction, just as, for instance, the teaching profession doesn't seriously entertain the ethics of the marketplace. I've never seen why the medical profession should. But by the time we were beginning to talk about the affluent society and seeing what was happening in America, if we tried to introduce a health service at that point, we would have failed. We still have a chance, I think. Many of my own friends who are now elderly men in hospitals in this area and elsewhere are beginning to look back with regret on what's been happening recently, because they see this revival of a commercial spirit among their colleagues and they rather deplore it. They've been used, many of them, to working their whole time in public hospitals, receiving salaries that they regard as adequate, not wishing to supplement their income by private practice, or at any rate only on a tiny scale, and regarding that as largely irrelevant to what they really want to do. And they're now seeing their younger colleagues in the last few years more and more finding opportunities to develop private practice and tending to neglect what they're being paid for in the public service, and they don't like it. And I'm worried about this too, and I know the reasons for it, political reasons for it, but I'm hoping they won't last much longer. But I don't think anything has gone irretrievably wrong yet. The biggest practical problem in the health service is still the way it is managed. We haven't solved this because we've taken it right out of any kind of system of representative government. We've created ad hoc authorities of all sorts, and we don't really know how to make them work. I don't know whether the latest changes are going to make them work, but at any rate, we do now have one thing. We have in each part of the country one authority which can look at the whole field of healthcare and decide how to do its budgeting. And that, I think, is a step forward.
Thank you very much.